The novelist Dennis Wheatley, thriller writer, Satanist, erotomane, and bore, was somewhat surprisingly a collector of first editions. Blackwell's catalogue of his library, issued in 1979, ran to 2,274 items, including much of the author's research material. A few choice items from the library, however, were sold before the catalogue was issued, and I was lucky enough to buy the best of these, a copy of the first edition of D.H. Lawrence's Sons and Lovers in the exceedingly scarce original dust wrapper. It cost £400, which was rather a lot, but I was an avid book collector in those days, and the book immediately became the jewel of my not very distinguished Lawrence collection. I could not find at the time, and have not found since, any further examples of the book in its original dust wrapper. And it is one of the striking oddities of the trade in modern books that the dust wrapper of a book is worth 10 times, and sometimes much more, than the book itself. Books without their wrappers are regarded as incomplete, which seems a little silly, as if they were Chippendale chairs without legs. Not that this wrapper in any case was particularly attractive, though it did have a brief notice on it, which is reckoned to have been written by Lawrence himself. As this blurb implies, Sons and Lovers has a doubly distinctive place in English literature. It is one of the earliest novels to use psychoanalytic insight as an organizing principle, and it is the first great novel about working-class life written, as it were, by an insider. Born in 1885, the son of a Nottinghamshire coal miner who married a woman of petty bourgeois background and aspiration, the precocious young Lawrence steeped himself in literature. His home village of Eastwood had an active literary culture, and Lawrence received a high-quality education, which culminated in matriculation at Nottingham University College in 1906, after coming first in the entrance exam. He left Nottingham with a first-class degree and began a few unhappy years teaching in Croydon. He published The White Peacock in 1911 and The Trespasser in 1912 to favourable receptions, but they didn't generate enough income to live on. He'd had an advance of £50 on his first novel, which prompted an incredulous response from his coal miner father. "And you've never done a day's work in your life," he said. He returned for a brief visit to Eastwood in March of 1912 and visited his favourite university professor, Ernest Weekly, who had a young and thoroughly attractive wife, Frieda von Richthofen. Only 6 weeks later, Lawrence and Frieda, leaving behind her young children, had eloped for the continent.
That first meeting must have affected us both because we were eager to meet again and again. And that was the time we began to get more intimate. I didn't seem to have any choice. I must be Lawrence's wife, come hell or high water.
At last, he was happy in love, and it freed him immediately. Lawrence had found himself in adolescence torn between the fierce ambition of his mother and the competing claims of his first love, Jessie Chambers, as her brother Jonathan recalls.
My sister was quite unshakable in her own views. It's usually assumed that the reason for the break was the influence exercised by Lawrence's mother. She also was a very strong-minded woman, with her own ideas, and very jealous of his close association with my sister and our family. But I don't think that is the whole story. I do feel that it was the uncompromising sense of rightness of my sister as well which contributed.
Jessie, an intelligent woman in her own right, had helped him with the early versions of the text.
He sent his manuscript regularly to her. Bundles of manuscripts came of Sons and Lovers, and she would pore over them and make corrections or suggestions and write considerably herself, seemed to me, and return them. So it suggests that he did value her views. And, of course, his final version was different from the one she thought he ought to have written and, of course, different from what had actually happened. And she was shocked by it, and she felt he had not been just to himself as well as to her.
He'd believed, though, that he would never be able to love anyone else while his mother was still alive. And, as if in unconscious acknowledgement, Lydia Lawrence died in 1911, just when Lawrence had published his first book. It allowed him, as a self-conscious catharsis, to write his own story. Paul Morrell, as Sons and Lovers was originally entitled, was, he avowed, the best thing he'd ever done. He'd said this in November of 1912 to Edward Garnett, to whom he'd been introduced by Ford Madox Ford in 1911. Garnett, himself a novelist, acted as a reader for a number of publishers and was an even better editor than he was a writer. And though he was talking a good game, Lawrence was in fact worried. Worried about the fate of his manuscript, which had just been rejected by Heinemann, the publisher of his first two novels. Mr. Heinemann thought the novel just that little bit improper.
I feel that the book is unsatisfactory. Its want of reticence makes it unfit, I fear, for publication in England as things are. The tyranny of the libraries is such that a book far less outspoken would certainly be damned.
Lawrence, as he soon confessed to Garnett, was disappointed by the response. He spluttered, he imprecated, he flounced. England, it was clear, didn't deserve Sons and Lovers, and it certainly didn't deserve D.H. Lawrence. A torrent of invective satisfyingly purged, Lawrence was immediately pacified by Garnett, who helped him to whip the book into publishable form. And in any case, Lawrence was by this time happily resident in Italy, swooningly in the arms of Frida, and already beginning the sequence of love poems that was to be published in 1916 as Look, We Have Come Through, which caused the fastidious Bertrand Russell to remark that they may have come through, but he didn't see why we should have to look. Russell and Lawrence had first met in Cambridge a few years before, and soon, greatly taken by each other, considered some sort of joint project. But they eventually and inevitably fell out, as Russell recalls.
When he realized that other people existed, he hated them. But most of the time, he lived in a solitary world of his own imaginings, peopled by phantoms as fierce as he wished them to be. A sensitive would-be despot, who got angry with the world because it would not instantly obey. His excessive emphasis on sex was due to the fact that in sex alone he was compelled to admit that he was not the only human being in the universe. But it was because this admission was so painful that he conceived of sex relations as a perpetual fight in which each is attempting to destroy the other.
Even Frida sometimes found the tumultuous Lawrence rough going. She'd helped him to finish the final draft of Sons and Lovers.
I'd never seen anybody so absorbed. He'd read to me and make me read some of his writing. I thought maybe this is good.
Lawrence had found in Frida, as again in Garnett, a perfect person to provide the support, encouragement, and loving engagement to finish his novel. Garnett, in fact, trimmed about 10% of the final manuscript version, much to its benefit. You did the pruning jolly well, Lawrence said. I hope you'll be able to barber up my novels for me for a long time in the future. When the book was published by Duckworth in 1913, reviews were generally favourable, though a little concerned by Mr. Lawrence's topics. Lawrence was pleased by the attention, but having finished a work, he quickly moved on to the next. A novel was done when it went to the publishers, the internal business that it enacts finally incarnate on the printed page. But in the case of Sons and Lovers, there was a last and not entirely congenial duty. Garnett requested that he design the dust wrapper himself. Lawrence was a bit nonplussed. In those days, nobody thought much about dust wrappers, which were utilitarian things, usually lacking illustration, and frequently disposed of by the bookshop assistant at point of purchase. It was apparent, in giving Lawrence this brief, that Duckworth saw the major selling point of the book in the fact that it was an inside account of working-class life. Could Lawrence, they inquired, design a wrapper with a picture of a coal mine on it? Exasperated, Lawrence pointed out that he was living on a lakeside in Italy and there were no coal mines within miles, and that, in any case, his artistic powers weren't up to the task. He tried, he failed, and he gave over the commission to his friend Ernest Collings, who couldn't do it either. Eventually, Duckworth, who were curiously incapable of finding an illustrator who could draw a coal mine, produced the book in a plain wrapper with Lawrence's blurb on the front cover. So, the dust wrapper of Sons and Lovers, bearing the author's own précis of the novel, has something more than fetishistic value. But it still has plenty of that. A nice, crisp, unwrappered copy of the book is probably worth £1,000 today. No wrappered one has appeared since that copy of Dennis Wheatley's, and mine, in 1979. It's hard to guess what one would fetch today, but with dust-wrappered first editions of The Great Gatsby or The Sun Also Rises now breaking the £50,000 barrier, it's hard to see that Sons and Lovers would be worth a lot less. Lawrence would be both amused and horrified. He cared nothing of first editions, and he never read a single one of his books once it had been published. He disposed of the manuscript of Sons and Lovers by swapping it for a farm in New Mexico, owned by his friend and patron Mabel Dodge Lewin, who later used the manuscript to pay for her treatment by her psychoanalyst. Lawrence probably got the worst of the deal. By the time of the transaction in 1924, it was an important manuscript, and the ranch was a pretty poor ranch. But he wouldn't have cared. Manuscripts, like books, were not forms of money, just pieces of paper. This makes me, as a dealer, feel sufficiently humbled. The content is what matters, the trappings merely a question of time and place. To an engaged reader, what does it matter what edition he may be reading? But I still wish I had my wrappered Sons and Lovers back. Alas, I sold it in my first catalogue as a bookseller in 1982 for £1,850. A decent profit, but an occasion doubly embarrassing in retrospect. First, I should have kept it, to bookseller's lament. And second, and more importantly, I so loved the rarity of it that I had a headline above my catalogue entry, in capitals, which read, "In the Dust Wrapper!" Exclamation point. The capitals are in retrospect forgivable, but the exclamation point is not. Exclamation points are most frequently employed by people who use little hearts to dot their I's and draw smiley faces. In the following 22 years, I've never used one again. If the apocryphal brave little Spartan boy could remain impassive while a fox was chewing on his vitals, eschewing exclamations of any kind, then I resolved, so could I.